Great. Thank you very much. So maybe I should preface by saying this talk is kind of very different. There won't be any integrable systems today, unfortunately, unless we get to the very last slide. So there's motivation. And it's going to be a lot more mathy than some of the other talks. But anyway, but everything we're doing is inspired. So this is a reporting on a joint project with David Nadler, which is kind of the general theme is to try to understand it as much of representation theory as one can from studying gauge theory, or I guess in this conference we're supposed to say from the six-dimensional theory. But in any case, the idea is somehow that representation theory of a group G can be captured by G gauge theories in low dimensions. And the algebraic structure in representation theory is given by looking at the operations given in a topological field theory. Specifically, the construction of representations in geometric representation theory is going to be given by gauging of sigma models. More elaborate structures, so representations themselves are going to be captured by singularities in the gauge theory. The theme we're talking about today is going to be traces or characters in representations, and those have to do with compactification on a circle. The more exciting things have to do with Langlands duality, which is captured in field theory by S-duality. What I wanted to start with is just the idea of dimension in topological field theory. So what do I mean by dimension? Suppose I have an n-dimensional topological quantum field theory. And if I compactify it on an n-1 manifold, I assign the Hilbert space of the theory, so quantization on m cross r. So this is my vector space. I'm going to denote z of m. What is the dimension of this vector space? Well, this is something that you can read off of the field theory very nicely. So first of all, if you look at m with the opposite orientation and you quantize, you get, well, let's just call it z of m opposite. But there's a relation between these two. Namely, we can look at these kind of two elbows, an incoming elbow and an outgoing elbow. And these give us maps by the, this is part of the structure of the field theory. We get a map from, we have incoming z of m and z of m op, and there's a pairing that gives us a complex number. So we think reading this diagram from left to right, we start out with two vector spaces and end up with just a complex number. That's a pairing. And reading the diagram in the opposite direction, we get something called the co-evaluation, which it goes from the complex numbers to z of m tensor z of m dual. So these are just structures we have from having a field theory. And what they also satisfy some relation. Namely, if we have this kind of Markov Zorro diagram that you go right and left and right. And that tells you that there's a map. If you start from z of m, you go to the middle, you have these three circles. That's z of m, tensor z of m op, tensor z of m. And then you go to the right. That's this composition has to be the identity, because it's just rewriting a cylinder in a funny way. So that tells us that these map, the evaluation, co-evaluation, satisfy some equation, which I won't write down. And that equation is the definition of what's called a dualizable vector space. A vector space is dualizable if we have another vector space. So z of m has another vector space called z of m op. And they have maps satisfying these funny relations. Now, this is a very complicated way of just saying finite dimensional vector space. Dualizable here is just a fancy word for finite dimensional. And whenever you have a finite dimensional vector space, you have all these relations. In particular, we can calculate, well, what are these maps? Z of m op is just the dual vector space. The co-evaluation, the map from C to so here, z of m tensor z of m op, that's endomorphisms of my vector space. Vector space that's its dual is endomorphisms. Endomorphisms have two natural structures. There's the identity and map, and there's the trace. And those are your evaluation and co-evaluation. So having this structure is just a fancy way of saying you have a finite dimensional vector space, but saying it in topological field theory language. And in particular, you get the dimension of your vector space is something you read off just by looking at the circle. So if you read on the circle, you start from C, you do your co-evaluation, then you do your evaluation. So that's my evaluation of, I guess this is not a very efficient pointer, but evaluation of co-evaluation of 1, that's what I attach to the circle. That's just the trace of the identity matrix. So that's the dimension of the vector space. Everyone happy so far? That's right. So I'm assuming I have a topological field theory that's fully defined on all manifolds up to the dimension, which of course is not what you have in most interesting examples. So later we'll see things that don't have vectors, finite dimensional vector spaces. But so here I'm just saying, suppose you had a full axiomatic definition of a topological field theory, then all these things have to be defined, and then you'll... That's right. So, okay, so this is a fancy way of saying dimension, and now what I'd like to do is get dimensions of more interesting things. So I'd like to talk about these extended topological field theories, where we're going to take gauge theories or other field theories and compactify in lower dimensional manifolds. And these have more interesting structures. These are interesting structures of singularities in the field theory. There's various defects or OPE algebras of local operators, categories of brains. There are a lot of interesting structures we get out of field theory. And so some caricatures of this, if I look at, say, I have a two-dimensional field theory, there's a category of brains attached to it. Which I think of by quantizing the theory and point cross R2 as a kind of, or this is maybe a more familiar picture, I think of the kind of boundary conditions, they naturally form a category. If I look in a 3D field theory, there's a category of line operators in this field theory, which you get by quantizing on a circle cross R2. In a 4D field theory, you have a category of line operators also from a two-sphere cross R2. Here the sphere is the linking of your line. You have a line in four dimensions, you look at its link, it's a two-sphere. And so we get a category attached to it. Or if you had a 4D field theory and you went all the way down to a circle cross R3, you get the structure of surface operators. Surface operators mathematically have a very rich structure of a two category. So I'm not going to need any of these things in detail. Just somehow the idea is that looking at kind of defects or local operators in field theories give you a lot of very, very rich mathematical structures beyond vector spaces, various categories or two categories. That's right. So in any case, so that the rubric I'm using for this extended field theory. So there's mathematician notation and physicist notation. Physicist notation, I say I like a two-sphere cross R2 or S1 cross R2. Mathematician would say if I have an extended field theory, it's a functor that assigns various things to various lower dimensional manifolds. So mathematician just erase the R2. Yeah. So I have in 3D field theory, I have S1. So S1 in three dimensions gives you a category. So in physics notation, this would be S1 cross R2. Mathematically, just what the extended field theory assigns to a circle. Same thing in 4D field theory. I'm going to a two-sphere. In a 4D field theory, I get a category. But if I went all the way down to a circle, I'd get a two-category. Okay. So this is just to say that looking at, and I'm sure everyone's familiar, that looking at field theories in higher dimensions, there's a lot of very, very elaborate structures for singularities or local operators. And the main thing I want to get is that you can draw the same picture I just drew, and to say that all of these things you're going to get, anything that a field theory assigns to anything, is dualizable. Now, what is dualizable? Well, before it was just a vector space, so it meant finite dimensional. But in any case, dualizable means, you know, whatever I have, whatever I assign to any manifold, say cross R1 or cross R2, cross R3, I can assign something to the opposite manifold, opposite orientation. And I have, again, exactly the same elbow, incoming elbow, outgoing elbow, Zorro diagram equals the identity. And so we get that these, and this gives you a mathematical definition of what it means to be dualizable for a category, a two-category, any of these more elaborate objects. But it follows automatically that whatever you see in a field theory, since you can draw these pictures, will have this dualizable property. And particularly, there's a notion of dimension. So dimension is just what you get by compactifying on a circle. Take whatever you do, cross it with an extra circle, you get something, and that's going to be what we call the dimension. So that's right. So the dimension of, so let me, this is an example of decategorification. If you started with a vector space, its dimension is a number. If you start with a category, like line operators, you'll get a vector space, like loop operators. If you get started with a two category, you'll get a category, and so on.
Okay, so when you're talking about categories and vector spaces,
that's right, but it's more precisely, it's taking a Hochschild homology, which is very closely linked to K-theory.
Okay,
there's a map,
yeah.
We'll get to this later, typically the way two categories appear is not just abstractly as a two category. You really have an algebra in categories. You have a category with a multiplication, like line operators maybe, and you look at the two category of all modules for it. That's typically two categories arise as modules for categories. Yeah, is it two categories? So then you can really think of this as Hochschild homology or of that algebra. So that's really concretely what that means in practice. Hochschild homology of an algebra in categories is itself a category. But anyway, so that's we're not going to need this kind of more abstract stuff. But the point is that there's a very general theory called Hochschild homology for dualizable objects in infinity or higher categories. We'll take it as a black box, but it means something that everyone knows working with field theory. Just means what you get by reducing on a circle. Technically, there's an extra thing you could do. When you reduce on a circle, you can work equivalently for circle rotation. So whatever this dimension that you have, this thing you put in a circle, it has an extra symmetry, which is rotation. And that really gives the theory of cyclic homology rather than, so there's a refined notion of dimension where you keep track of circle rotation. And that's the theory of cyclic homology, but again, we'll suppress this distinction today. How high can you go? Well, it depends on your field theory. You know, if you started with a four-dimensional field theory, if it gives you an extended topological field theory, so in typical examples, you won't get a number attached to a four-manifold. Like Nikita was saying, typically your vector spaces won't be finite dimensional, so you can't, say, cross with a circle and get a number. But you can go down. Typically, the belief is that, you know, any honest-to-God field theory will be able to extend it all the way to a point. So, for example, in a 4D field theory, you should have a three-category attached to a point. Well, you start, yeah, but yeah, so you take the 6D CFD, you should have something really cool way down there. Yeah, this operation is purely, you can keep, yeah, this is abstract. But, you know, again, all the interesting, the kind of philosophy, it's all the interesting examples come from the physics anyway. So if the physics doesn't go higher, the representation. There's no bound in the math to how many, the definition goes arbitrarily high. The question about the examples. And all the interesting examples we know come out of the physics. So there's a bound on how complicated they are. But there are not so many interesting field theory in so many high dimensions that we know of, so. So I want to say what kind of theorems can we prove about this? What kind of results can we get? And of course, working in this kind of generality, I've kind of used nothing. So it's hard to get something that looks like much of a theorem. So what can you say? Well, one thing you could say is, well, you know, in physics language, it'll be that preservation under domain walls. So you have two theories living on two different sides of a wall. And you have something you see in one theory. And then you pass it under this domain wall to the other theory. You'll get something in the other theory. And the dimensions will be preserved. So in other words, you get if you have the theory W compactified in some manifold M, the theory Z compactified on a manifold M, you put your wall, you get a map from dimension of W of M to dimension of Z of M. If these dimensions are numbers, you're just going to say some equality. But in general, they're going to be interesting maps. No, I'm just drawing this kind of schematically. W of M, M is whatever map. M is something in the field theory. So M is, you know, I have some wall between, say, four-dimensional gauge theories. M is, you know, some Riemann surface. And I look at what this category, you know, what my field theory assigns to a Riemann surface cross R2 as a category. Then I have a domain wall, like S-duality. Then that'll give me on the other side a functor from the dimension of, well, a map from the dimension of this to dimension of that. It's not actually pictured. I'm just drawing W and Z. I'm not actually drawing M. So M is going to be some extra compact dimensions that I'm going to put over this picture. So I'm just saying, suppose I have two theories on two sides of a wall, then anything I calculate should be able to translate. So the most familiar example of this is just boundary conditions. A boundary condition is something, it's a domain wall with a trivial theory. And this is a construction, if you like, of the boundary state. If I give you a boundary condition for the theory Z, I get a vector in Z of M, which is the state of the boundary. That's what I get from this domain. Well, and then I get dimension of V is an element of the vector space dimension of Z of n. So that's sort of the formalism of boundary states. If I have a, D brain, then it has a charge, which is a vector in what the field theory assigns to the circle. That's the, this dimension. So let me, so when, again, I don't want to belabor the formalism. There's a mathematical language of saying this. If I have a map between two dualizable objects, like a functor of two dualizable categories or something like that, then there's a, you get a map. Let me, if I call that map F star, then there's an induced map dimension of F star between the dimensions of the two things. And the theorem you can prove is that dimension is a symmetric monoidal functor. So it behaves nicely with respect to tensor products and various things. So anyway, there's some formalism of what this dimension does. But what I want to point out is one particular consequence of this, which is the notion of churned character or characters. So if I have a boundary, so this is the analog of the boundary state. If I have a map from the unit to C, that's a dualizable object of C, then I have a character. So given an object of C, it has a character, which is an element of the dimension of C. And this satisfies some natural functoriality. If I have an element of C and I have a map to D, then I get then I have an equality that the kind of charge of push forward of V is the push forward of the charge of V. I'll get to that. So this is the abstract nonsense, and I want to explain what this is in examples. So this theorem, this result, if you'd like, we can, David Nadler and I proved directly, it also follows from a much more general result, which is Jacob Lurie's cobordism hypothesis with singularities, which is sort of a theory that explains everything about defects of topological field theories with all their defects and operations and so on. But anyway, I wanted to get to something more concrete. So let's just talk about this in the B model. So what does this, all this stuff mean in the B model? So what do I mean? First, let's take X to be an algebraic variety. So to an algebraic variety, or as you know, complex manifold, I'm not necessarily assuming smooth or compact, actually. I have a complex space. You can talk about a category attached to it, which is the given by complexes of vector bundles on it, or more precisely, the derived category of coherent sheaves. So in the case where X is a smooth compact manifold, this is what we'd call the category of B brains on X. So if you have a smooth compact manifold, there's a category which is complexes of vector bundles. And that's, in this case, indeed, there is a full two-dimensional topological field theory satisfying all the axioms that assigns this to a point, that assigns this category to a point across R2. But if you don't have the smoothness and compactness, you won't have a full 2D field theory, but you can still talk about this category. So this is the typical kind of thing. I don't need the full, let me get to an example. So in this case, this category, whether or not you have smoothness and compactness, you can calculate what the dimension of this category is. And what is the dimension of the category? Well, it's what you'll get by looking at the B model on the circle. So before we had the B model on a point, so now you look on the circle. And this is the Delboeck homology of X. So again, this result holds whether or not you're smooth or compact. The dimension of this gives you Delboeck homology. And if you keep track of the circle action on the circle, this gives you Durand cohomology. If you're smooth and compact, you don't sense the difference between them anyway. And for example, if I give you a vector bundle, that's an object of my category, which I can think of as a boundary condition, then this vector bundle has my state, this charge, which is just the churn character. So a vector bundle is an object of the category. It gives you a vector in the dimension of the category. That dimension we decided is just cohomology. And that's this is the usual churn character. So this is just saying that this is the B model. I'm just saying that this is if you have a D brain, which is in the B model, it's an object of derived category, it has a charge, which is just the churn character. Okay. Okay. All right. Right. Okay. Okay, I'll remove it. anyway, but I think that from in this point of view, the point is K theory is essentially K-theory is just an avatar for the category itself. So from this point of view, that you know, that there's the object in the category itself is in some sense of what you might call the charge. But right. Yeah, but they're all captured by the object of the category. Yeah. Well, it's an object of the category. I mean, the category knows about the K-theory of the category in particular. So I think of the character construct. But anyway, this is a terminology issue. But the brain is for me is an object of the category, or you can think of its shadow as an object in K-theory, and then it has a state. Let me not, I won't use the word charge. It has a state attached to it, which is the Chern character, which is an element of cohomology. But in any case, I appreciate the objection, and we'll refrain from using the terminology. But sustained, exactly. But what I'd like to talk about is functoriality. So we have this very general functoriality, and this functoriality gives you a functoriality. So what are the kind of domain walls in the B model? They could be given by maps of complex manifolds or more general correspondences of complex manifolds. And what you get out of this, there's a functoriality. Given such, say, for example, a map, you can push forward your brain. You can push forward a sheaf and get a sheaf downstairs. And there's a theorem that says that this functoriality theorem says that these states attached to a sheaf behave well, are functorial. In other words, the push forward of the state is the state of the push forward. Now, Greg will object. The category attached to B model to a point is. Yeah, well, dualizable. Let me not say fully, but yeah, dualizable. The category, the B brains, category of brains is dualizable for anything. So this result doesn't assume any smoothness or compactness. I do need that the map F is a proper map. That's important. Nothing else is important. Now, you may very well object, as Greg already did, where's the tau genus, a hat genus? And the point is that this is functoriality on Hochschild homology versus not on Durand cohomology. They're isomorphic, but the isomorphism involves the a hat genus. So this form of functoriality is much easier to say here. It doesn't have any a hat genuses. It's a general. It just worked. So this theorem is a form of Grothendieck-Riemann-Roch theorem. It's a very general form of Grothendieck-Riemann-Roch, or in the case where Y is a point, this is just the Hertzeburg-Riemann-Roch. This is, I learned from Greg and Graham's paper, the formulation of Hertzeburg-Riemann-Roch in this language. So you can say a very general form of Grothendieck-Riemann-Roch where you have eliminated these kind of tau genus by looking at kind of Hochschild homology, and it follows just kind of for free from this general formalism. Okay, so that's the B model. Now let me do something. I want to get to representation theory. That's sort of my goal. So first, let's do the kind of instead of the B model, let me look at a GIA complex Lie group. More generally, I could have an affine group, but anyway, take your favorite complex Lie group, and I'm going to attach to it a category, which is the category of representations of this group, finite dimensional representations of this group, for example. Now, again, if G is a finite group, this category is what you'd attach to a point in a full two-dimensional field theory, this kind of Dyckhoff-Witten or finite group TQFT 2D field theory attached to your group. If G is not finite, then you might have trouble making this a full 2D field theory. But in any case, this is just like the B model picture. We don't need the full TFT. Now, what is the dimension? Well, you just need to take your gauge theory and look at your gauge theory on the circle. Fields of the gauge theory on the circle are just G mod G. So it's the group G with a conjugation action. This is just the fields of the theory on the circle. And the dimension of the category of representations is what your theory assigns to the circle, which is just class functions. Okay. So you class functions is what this gauge theory attaches to a circle. And in particular, given a representation, this notion state, is an object. So given a representation of the group, I'm supposed to attach it to class function. Well, what is that? Well, that's the character. So the character of a representation is, again, an example of the same story, just like the Chern character of a vector bundle. So I'm going to think of this I know this makes people often unhappy. I'm going to think of this gauge theory as a kind of a sigma model into point mod G, this orbifold or stack point mod G. And then this is the B model story I was doing before, literally. My vector bundles on point mod G, these are representations of G. And then the Hochschild homology in this case, what you attach to the circle, is class functions. Algebraic stack, yeah, absolutely, yeah. It's a point with G symmetries. No. No, it's finite dimensional. It has a homotopy type, which is, it's, this is a confusing thing that, for example, for B. Yeah, so BG is a perfectly nice finite kind of complex variety. What's confusing is there's a homotopy type that attached to B of the homotopy type G. That's also part of the story, but that's a different, the fact that CP infinity here is, for example, you know, BGL1, BC star, is not CP infinity the algebraic variety, it's CP infinity the homotopy type. And CP infinity the homotopy type is, well, it's included in this kind of language, but it appears in a very different setting. So if you took a BC star as the algebraic group, you get a perfectly nice algebraic stack, which is point mod C star. But there's a homotopy type attached to it, which is B of C star, the constant group, just the topological group C star. And that's, so this is all captured in the language of this derived algebraic geometry. Derived algebraic geometry has kind of two kinds of sides to it. There's algebraic geometry, and there's homotopy theory. And they're mixed in a very nice way. So both objects, take your favorite homotopy type, is an object of derived algebraic geometry. Your favorite algebraic variety is an object of derived algebraic geometry. But in general, they're somehow, live in somehow perpendicular directions. Yes. It's point mod C star. It's a stack which
I have to think about it. Of course. Yeah, it's not okay, so first of all, it's a stack.
Yeah.
Oh, so if anything, it's dimensionally minus one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so now let me combine these two stories, the kind of B model and the gauge theory. They were kind of the same anyway. Well, from one point of view. So let me just talk in general about gauging a B model. So I have a variety X, I have a group action on it. So I can talk about the gauged B model into X, or the way I would think about it mathematically is I take the quotient stack or quotient orbifold if G is finite, X mod G, and think of the B model of X mod G. In these cases, there's a natural space I can attach to it, which is called the loop space, the derived loop space, or roughly speaking, what's called the inertia stack. So if I have a group G acting on a space X, I can look at the set of pairs of a group element and a point which it stabilizes, and then mod out by G. This is called the inertia of the orbifold. And you can think of it as kind of, it's part of the loop space. It's a kind of the B model kind version of the loop space. So I'm not allowing any kind of very large loops, but my loops are allowed to wrap around automorphisms of points. So I have a group with, I have a space with some symmetry, some orbifold. I'm allowed to have loops that kind of wrap around the symmetry of a point, but not loops that kind of actually traverse the variety. This is the same kind of a distinction. There's kind of a homotopy theory kind of loop and algebraic geometry kind of loop. I'm not allowing A model type loops where I kind of really move around the variety. I'm just have these. So let me call this loop space. So for example, the inertia, if you have your orbifold point mod G, then it's inertia. This is a pair of an element in a point in point mod G. There's just the point. And then a group element preserving it, that's a group G. So this G mod G is an example of this loop space construction. So in this generality, you can prove that the B model, this category of brains, it has a dimension. Its dimension is just the Ram cohomology of this loop space, of this inertia. So that's something that includes our various examples. So this is where boundary states. This is where the states associated to brains will naturally live. They live in the cohomology of this inertia space. It's kind of, this is basically what's called orbifold cohomology. So let me give you an example of what you can do with this setting. So suppose I have a space X and a map. There's maps to the point. Well, there's the map to the point. So let's look at X mapping to a point. Now suppose G is acting on X, so this is a G equivariant map. G is acting the only way it can on a point. I can think of that as giving a map from the quotients, from the quotient X mod G to the quotient point mod G. And now physically I think I should say this is a domain wall between kind of a gauge sigma model on X and just a pure gauge theory, where I'm integrating out the X fields. So what do you get out of this? You get a map. But it, I mean, this is a functor between two B models. If I think of this as two B models, right, so this is a domain wall between those B models. You have two different. That's a two-dimensional theory.
So where's
the domain wall? You know, there's an X mod G on one side, and they have point mod G.
Something that lives in a point space, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's a
Yeah, so I have on one side I have X mod G, the other side I have point mod G. These are two different B models. These are two completely different topological field theories. And there's a functor between.
Is it different from going to an effective low energy theory where you just integrate out? I mean, the words you're using here, mm-hmm. you describe as pi, doesn't seem more like you integrated out fields and producing some effective low energy theory rather than a domain involved with some object.
But there is an object. I mean, the point is there is an object between these two field theories. There is something that lives on the
well,
on the boundary.
Also be such an object. I mean, you could imagine yeah. domain involved between any.
Yeah, so that's what I'm considering. So maybe I shouldn't use it. So maybe you should project the integration out, not to.
In theory, which you discussed, where it actually comes with effects, it actually is apparent.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Mm-hmm. So when you integrate out the X fields, you do get.
Yeah.
Kind of
so maybe this, I think, so I'll let me erase this line. So there is a domain wall, but it's not, let's not call it integrating out. There is a domain wall between X mod G and point mod G. The claim is that this domain, yeah, there's a category attached to X mod G, there's a category attached to point mod G, there's a functor between them.
So the domain wall is a functor between
yeah. That's right. And if you take these field theories and you look at what they assign to any manifold, well, they're not a lot of manifold. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so there's a fully fledged domain wall, but yeah, let me eliminate this terminology. But in any case, there's a map from these loop spaces, a map from loops in X to loops in point mod G. So let me just spell it. This is sort of the most interesting map here. So I want to keep this around. I have X to a point, so I write X mod G to point mod G. So you have, suppose I give you such a map. Forget about any physics terminology I may have abused. There's a map like this. More generally, maybe let me keep up here. Suppose I have any map of orbifolds or stacks in general, but this is going to be the example I'm going to look at. So to such a map, you can attach a map of loop spaces. So these loop spaces, these are probably somewhat unfamiliar. I don't mean this infinite dimensional loop. Yeah, that's right. But it's something very concrete. So that's why I don't want to get into all this terminology. This is G mod G. Now, loops into a, so there's this notion of loop space, which is I can elaborate on more. But there's this, so given a map pi, there's an induced map L pi. And there's this same thing works in general, given any map pi, you get a map between loop spaces. These really are some space of kind of small loops. So I'm not allowing, this is really the loop space that's seen in the B model. So I'm not allowing big loops around the variety, but I'm allowing small loops and I'm allowing, And so now the general theorem you can prove is that dimensions, if I give you such a map, and in all of these cases, I'm going to require that pi is proper. So the fibers are compact. So the claim is that push forward for such a map is given by integration on loop spaces. So this is kind of a very general form of Grothendieck-Riemann-Roch theorem. So I just want to say it. In our particular case, we have here on this slide, we have the loop space of X mod G. We said it's just this concrete thing. It's a set of pairs, a point in X, and a group element preserving it. Loop space of point mod G is just elements of G up to conjugation. And what's the map? It's the obvious map. You just forget X. Okay. Now, what does this map look like? Well, if you give me a conjugacy class in the group, what is the fiber over this? It's just a set of points that are preserved by that group element. So it's just a fixed point set. So this map is just a nice way of collecting the information of all the fixed point set of all elements of the group. Okay, that's what this map does. But the claim is that if we just assume X just needs to be compact, G needs to be affine, then this functoriality on dimensions, this kind of Grothendieck-Riemann-Roch type result, is just given by integration on the loop space. So in other words, the claim, the dimension of your grains on X is given by forms on the loop space. Dimension of representations of G is given by forms on G mod G. And the map is just integrate. Just take forms upstairs, integrate them over the fibers of this map. And this follows this theorem follows for free from this complete abstract nonsense that we were saying before. So this is a general functoriality map. Now, we said before it includes Grotendieck Riemann rock, but what I'd like to claim to you is that this is a very general form of the Thiebaud localization theorem. I guess that's in the next slide. So again, this is just reiterating. It's saying that the push forward on these characters is given by just integration over this very geometric map. And again, the claim is this is a tautology, and it's probably obvious physically in the right language. But now the claim is that this is a form of a Thiebaud, a very general form where we don't assume any smoothness, any transversality, any nothing. So what is a Thiebaud? So suppose I give you a manifold with an equivariant vector bundle on it, right? So I can think of that equivariant vector bundle as a vector bundle on the quotient. It's a vector bundle that's invariant under the symmetries. Now, what are you interested in when you have an equivariant vector bundle? You want to calculate its character. So that you take the alternating, you'd like the cohomology of X with coefficients in V. You get a virtual representation of the group. That's what you're interested in when you have an equivariant vector bundle, the index, if you'd like. If we were doing K-theory, this is the cohomological version. And so you take this virtual representation, and you want to calculate its character. Character, we said, is just what this dim is. You have a representation of the group that's one of these brains on point mod G. Its character is this thing on G mod G. That's the class function that you're supposed to get. Now, what does this theorem say? This theorem says that this dimension is given by the integration of a function or a form on the loop space under this geometric map. What is that function? That is just the turn character of your vector bundle. Take your turn character of your vector bundle. That's naturally a function on the loop space of X. You push it forward. That just means you integrate it. Now, what does this integration mean? That means that the value at a conjugacy class is given by the integral over the fixed point set. So just without doing any work, you get that to calculate the character of this virtual representation, that character is just given by an integral of the turn character over the fixed point locus. Yeah, so that's the properness. The properness. Yeah, in the B model, in this B setting, all I need is that the map is compact. That's. Then you'd need to incorporate the gerb in the map. But there'd be twisting is easy in this language because a gerb is just another stack. So it's easy to just incorporate that into this language. So this is a version of a Thiebaud where you haven't assumed any kind of it works in families, no transversality assumption, no smoothness, no whatever. You just need that X, if you'd like, you started with X is compact. That's the properness. If you want this map, X mod G to point mod G to be proper, that's the same as you're saying X is compact. Okay, so maybe I'm getting behind time. There's a version of this which is, maybe it's wrong to say A model, there's a version for what's called D modules, which is kind of A brains on a cotangent bundle. You can do the same thing, you know, I didn't really use much, so you can imagine doing this in lots of settings. There's a category of what's known D modules, and I can think of these as B brains on a quantized cotangent bundle or something like A brains on the cotangent bundle. In any case, you can do it. But concretely, they're just vector bundles with flat connection. Maybe that's the easiest thing to say. Vector bundles with flat connections or sheaves with flat connection. And then the same exact story works. You calculate its dimension is given by some Durham cohomology of a loop space. This is David and I prove. So this tells me that if you give me a flat vector bundle, which is equivariant, it has a turn character, which is a Durham cohomology class of this inertia loop space. And now the same functoriality works. Let me not, I'm skipping over this, happy to discuss later. But this is, you get the Lefschetz fixed point formula. If you want to calculate ordinary Durham cohomology with coefficients in, say, a local system or just constant coefficients, well, that's cohomology with coefficients in a flat vector bundle. That's things that generalize Durham cohomology to various twisted coefficients. And again, you can calculate the traces of this representation, if you give me an automorphism of your manifold and you want to understand how the traces of this acting on the cohomology of a vector bundle, you can calculate this by counting fixed points. So all of your favorite kind of fixed point formulas, like Lefschetz type formulas, or a Thiebaud, they're all given very, very simply by this map, just by the observation that characters are given by integration over these maps of loop spaces. So here I'm doing everything in the algebraic setting. So I have an algebraic variety. And I'm looking at a flat vector bundle on it, or a D module on it. No, but that's a flat connection. It's sort of telling you this is a kind of discreteness. And it's saying that, well, yeah, flat connections is a discrete version of you know, just vector bundles. But no, there's nothing fancy here. It's really just exactly the same story I said in the B model before. If you do it for this, you know, quantized B model of the cotangent bundle, you get the Lefschetz story. Okay, so I want to get to the part that relates to representation. How am I doing on time? What's the?
You're still within the 1 hour.
Great, but great. That's fine. Yeah, right. So now, so what I'd like to talk about is so one of the first applications of TIABOT back. Right. Yeah, exactly. So one of the classical applications of a TIABOT was to prove the vowel character formula. This is in the TIABOT paper. And you can do a very nice, well, that follows from this. Well, let me work this out explicitly in this case. Actually, for this story, let's assume now it's easier to pretend that G and K are, say, finite groups. Say we're in this Dagger-Witten kind of theory. So that makes everything much easier to understand. But you can assume that they're not finite, if you like. So take a homogeneous space. Take G mod K. And now we'd like to understand functions on G mod K as a representation of the group G. Okay? So G acts on G mod K. It acts on functions on G mod K. This is known as the induced representation. And so in particular, you can think of functions. Well, that's sections of this trivial vector bundle, if you'd like. So it fits into this formula. You have the trivial vector bundle on X. It's equivariant. You can look at sections. That's functions. Now you want to understand what is the character of the induced representation. Well, this is something that Frobenius knew. Let's see what it is in our language. You're supposed to take this loop space of X mod G gadget. What is that in this case? You're looking at X and G mod K and an element that stabilizes it, these pairs, up to the action of the group. Now if you work out what that is, that's something really simple. It's just K mod K. Well, if you like, G is acting transitively on G mod K. Right? So G mod K, this is something a little silly, G mod K mod G, that's point mod K. I'm just canceling out the Gs. And so its loop space is K mod K. Its inertia is this K mod K. But here there's a kind of, the left-hand side is, if you like, a more geometric version of K mod K. And now there's an obvious map from K mod K to G mod G, which is given just by inclusion of, induced by the inclusion of K and G. And what this theorem tells you is that the character of this functions on G mod K is given by the integral of 1. In other words, just take the function 1 on K mod K. And again, we can assume K is finite. So just take function 1 on the set K mod K and push it forward to G mod G. So just sum up over the fibers. You get a class function on G mod G. That's the character of the induced representation. So this is what Frobenius said without the stacks and loop spaces. So if you do this in for flag manifolds, you get the vowel character formula. And you get an object called the Springer resolution that people may be interested in independently. So let's, here I'm taking G to be a complex group. I'm going to say it in terms of complex group rather than compact groups, but it's just the familiar vowel character formula. So I have the Borel, the upper triangular matrices. And I look at the flag manifold G mod B. This is all flags in CN. And then what is this map? So we have this favorite space that we're always supposed to look at. This inertia, this is pairs of a group element and a flag, that's such that the flag contains my group element. And there's a map where you just forget the flag. Okay, so you look at n by n matrices, you look at a flag of subspaces that are preserved by it, look at that pair, and then you can just say forget the matrix and just remember the flag. Forget the flag and just remember the matrix. This is called the Grothendieck-Springer simultaneous resolution. It's kind of the main star of geometric representation theory. But here it's just this obvious. I mean, it's the natural thing to look at if you're looking at interested in vector bundles and flag manifold. And in particular, it has kind of cool geometry. If you look at unipotent elements in the group, its inverse image is this cool resolution of singularities. It has lots of cool geometry. But for now, all we care about for a vowel character formula is just that if you give me a regular semi-simple element in the group, if you give a matrix with distinct eigenvalues, there's only n factorial flags that contain it. You just need to permute its eigenspaces in one way or another. Those are the only ways to construct flags compatible with it. So the inverse image of a generic element in the group is just order of the vowel group number points. So this map is just a W to 1 cover, generically. And so if you give me a holomorphic line bundle that's equivariant for the group, so that now this is via Borel-Weil, this is how we think about representations of the group, then its character is just given by a sum over the vowel group of class functions. It's given explicitly as a sum over the vowel group. Which is this integration. So I'm not going to write it out. This is the familiar vowel character formula. It's just applying this map. Okay, so now that we, so this is hopefully somewhat familiar. I'm just writing the vowel character formula in a confusing way. What's the advantage is that now we can do the same thing for higher dimensional field theories. So now I want to talk about three dimensions, and after I run out of time, I want to talk about four dimensional field theories. So this is where it relates to geometric angles. But for now, let's just talk about three-dimensional gauge theory rather than two-dimensional. So there's a particular three-dimensional gauge theory I have in mind that David and I introduced in extended field theory language. Witten explains how to think of it as a specific topological gauge theory in three dimensions. But anyway, I'll tell you what I need out of it. So in this theory, I'm doing not two-dimensional gauge theory, but three-dimensional gauge theory. So I have sort of one extra level of complexity. So I'm going to replace group actions on vector spaces by group actions on categories. So that's somehow what's going to happen in this theory. Instead of you're going to add one extra level of complexity. So you ask, what do you mean by a group action on a category? And what would that possibly come from, this abstract thing? Well, it comes from something very concrete. You just take a group acting on a space, and now look at the collection of vector bundles, or flat vector bundles, that's what I'm going to care about. Look at flat vector bundles on the space X. If the group acts on the space, it takes any flat vector bundle to another flat vector bundle. So that's a group action on a category. No, those are going to be the fixed points. Equivariant vector bundles are kind of the fixed points of the section. Look at the category of all flat vector bundles.
No, I'm just saying, if I have a group action on a space, I have a vector bundle on a space, then the group action might have one limit.
Exactly. And so the action on the category may or may not preserve that element, right? If I take your vector bundle, any vector bundle, take your group element, you pull it back by the group element, you'll get another vector bundle. That other vector bundle may or may not be the same. So this action may or may not preserve this object of your category. But there's an action on the category for all vector bundles. Equivariant ones are basically the fixed points. Okay, so this is the kind of example I'm going to be interested in. And this is what happens in this 3D gauge theory. These are the kind of, and for the 3D gauge theory, this is all we need to care about, this kind of example. Look at the category of flat vector bundle on a space in which the group acts. These are the kind of boundary conditions in this 3D gauge theory, or really corner conditions, I guess. Okay, they're what this 3D gauge theory assigns to a point, or to R3, I guess I should say. So now, what is the dimension? Well, dimension, again, always goes from G to G mod G. Yeah, but there's a two-category to a point, and what is this two-category? It's a collection of all G categories. So in 2D gauge theory, to a point, we assign the collection of all G representations. We noticed that that was a category. In 3D gauge theory, we're going to attach a two-category to a point. What's that two-category? It's the collection of all G categories. The objects are the G categories. So if I give you an X with a G action, and I look at this category of vector bundle X, that's a particular D-brain, if you'd like. That's probably the wrong terminology here. It's a particular kind of boundaries condition for this 3D gauge theory. It's what the 3D gauge theory attaches to point. It's a collection of all possible such Xs, or if you like, all possible just categories with a G action. To the circle, we're going to attach, so now what happens to a circle? To a circle, we should attach just a plain category. And what is that plain category? It's instead of class functions, which is what we had in the 2D theory, we have class vector bundles, class flat vector bundles. So instead of looking at functions on G mod G, we look at flat vector bundles on G mod G, or if you like, flat connections on the group that are invariant under conjugation. So that's what this theory attaches to the circle. And these are basically what Lustig's theory of character sheaves gives you. So out of this, we are able to deduce some S-duality theorem for Lustig's character sheaves, which wasn't known. But this is a different direction. In any case, the point is that this character formula, this kind of Frobenius or Valla-Attiaboth character formula, works exactly the same. Works literally the same. You have the same. I take my X to be G mod B. So I'm looking at these flat vector bundles, D modules on G mod B. Then I have this push forward, this Ringer map we looked at before. And the theorem says, and again, it falls easily from this general nonsense, is that the dimension of this category, the kind of character, so that character should be itself a class vector bundle. Right? This is a specific representation of the group. Its character should be a specific class function. So the dimension is just what's known in representation theory, the Springer sheaf. It's the sheaf that the cohomology of the Springer fibers. So in other words, you just take the constant sheaf on this loop X mod G and integrate it to G mod G. So generically, that's, as I said, a W to one cover. So you're just adding W many vector spaces. But they get really, really interesting compact fibers at various points. So you're taking the cohomology of those compact fibers, and you get a vector bundle. Well, it's not really a vector bundle. It's a singular vector bundle. It's a D module on G mod G called the Springer sheaf. Okay, now, why is this relate to representation theory, people might know? Well, this same Springer sheaf is also known as the Harshandra system. So instead of thinking of it as a flat vector line, think of it as a system of differential equations. So I can think of this this D module is a system of differential equations on the group. So I'm looking at a particular G invariant system of differential equations on the group. That's this character I'm looking at. Now I ask, where do G invariant differential equations on the group come up? Sorry? Yeah, that's a specific one. It's just setting the Casimirs to some central character. So it's kind of the three-dimensional analog of a quantized Hitchin fiber. So anyway, what is this particular system? And if you like, these Casimirs are the kind of Bale and Sidrinfeld operators on dimension down. So what is this particular system? Let's now forget everything I just said. Harshandra was studying representations of Lie groups. He was studying, let's take a Lie group, you know, SL2R. Let's take some representation of SL2R. So these are typically infinite dimensional. So let's try to define the character of a representation. Now, the operators are not trace class. So if you just try to define directly what you mean by a character, you get nonsense. He says, OK, well, you actually do get a distributional character. If you smear with a test function, you do get a trace class operator. So you can define a character for one of these discrete series or whatever representation of SL2R. You can define it's a character. It's a distribution on the group, not a function on the group. And it's automatically conjugation invariant because it's a character. OK, so great. Now, that's still pretty bad, some crazy distribution in the group. But then Harshandra said, well, this distribution satisfies a very strong irregular holonomic system of differential equations because of the Casimirs, because all the Casimirs must act on it by a scalar. So it satisfies a regular holonomic system of differential equations from which you find that this distribution is actually real analytic function, L1 across the singularities. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful real analytic on the regular semi-simple locus. It's L1 across the singularities. It's a beautiful, very, very tame object for which you can write formulas. And Harshandra wrote these character formulas for them, at least for discrete series representations. OK, so this system, this particular system that Harshandra studied, is the one we're getting. If you take this category of D modules on G mod B, ask what its character is, it's the Harshandra system on the group. Now I ask you, what does that have to do with representation theory? How does that relate? So on one hand, we have these flat vector bundles on G mod B. On the other hand, we have this particular differential equation on the group, this Harshandra system. Well, there's a wonderful relation between the two worlds, which is this amazing theorem of Bale and Bernstein. Bale and Bernstein tell you that when you're studying these A-brains on T-star flags, or D modules on G mod B, they actually have a completely different realization in the world. This category appears in representation theory as representation theory of the Lie algebra. Just look at the category of modules for the Lie algebra of G. This is kind of a version of Borel-Weil in some sense. But this category of all infinite dimensional representations of the Lie algebra appear as these flat vector bundles, singular flat vector bundles on the flag manifold. So this is a bridge between the world of representation theory of Lie algebras or groups and this particular D modules. So what do you get out of this? Well, what David and I prove is that you exactly recover Harshandra's characters out of this abstract nonsense. In other words, what's the bridge? You start with your favorite representation of a real group and think of it in terms of the representation of complex Lie algebra. By Bale and Bernstein, that is one of these D modules on G mod B. Now, we said that the entire collection of D modules on G mod B has a character, which is this Springer sheaf, this Harshandra system on G mod B. So the entire category of D modules on G mod B has its character, is this particular system of equations on G mod G. Now, I'll give you a particular representation that gives you a solution of this system of equations. So I give you a particular representation that's, so it's kind of, now we're, if you'd like, in three dimensions, we have not just boundaries, but corners. We have kind of higher level, we have kind of boundary conditions inside of boundary conditions. This entire D modules of G mod B, in some sense, was a boundary condition. But now I have inside of that a particular object, which is somehow you can describe as a particular kind of defect in the 3D theory. But you have a particular object of this category. It gets a character which is now a solution of the character of the entire representation. So you get, before you get this entire collection of D module and G mod B has a character, which is this Harshandra system, a particular representation gives you a solution of a Harshandra system. In other words, you get a, and the point is this is Harshandra's distributional characters. Done just by, if you'd like, just by gauge theory without any analysis. But it allows you to understand a lot of formal properties of these things very nicely. So we expect to recover these kind of general character formulas of the kind that Harishchandra and more recently Schmidt and Vilonen proved for these representations. They're just going to be a version of the Weyl character formula for this map. We have everything here is completely geometric. Everything is described by this one map, this Grundig-Springer resolution, that tells you how to calculate these characters. This, by the way, I think relates to this Yang-Mills-Higgs theory of Gerasimov-Shatrashvili. I mean, the appearance of representations of complex groups there and their characters is the same. I mean, I can spell that out somewhere. But that's a reduction of this 3D theory. Anyway, so now that I'm out of time, I can talk about the, am I out of time? Hopefully. Great, 2 minutes. So now since I have to, let me just quickly say something about four-dimensional theory. So this relates to questions that, okay. I should say this, the Thiebaud theorem that I said before is a conjecture of Frankelin and Ngoe that we resolved. So now this is going to relate to where the context in which Frankelin and Ngoe came up with this. Okay, so now I want to talk about 40 gauge theory, in particular n equals 4 super Yang-Mills with this GL twist. But I'm now going to, I don't want to go into two categories or anything crazy. I'm just going to say now, in this four-dimensional gauge theory, you have this category attached to a Riemann surface. So this is calculated by Kapustin and Witten. You take this n equals 4 super Yang-Mills in this twist, you reduce it on a surface sigma, you get a 2D sigma model, and its category of brains is D modules on space of G moduli space, this D modules on space of G bundles on a Riemann surface, which you can Kapustin and Witten think of as A brains on the Hitchin space to connect to the other talk. So we look at A brains on the Hitchin space of G and sigma. So this is the main object of interest in geometric ionomers. You want to understand this category. So what do you want to ask about this category? Well, the first thing you might ask if you have a category is what is its dimension? This is, or in mathematics, what is its Hochschild homology or cyclic homology? This is the first thing you should ask if you have something that has some finiteness properties, some dualizability. You can ask, what is its dimension? And it follows from our general formalism with David that the dimension of this category, so physically you're taking this surface sigma and you're crossing with a circle. So that's what dimension is, just crossing with another circle. The dimension is given by the Durand cohomology of, well, just by this general nonsense, it's given by this loop space. So I already stated these kind of theorems that the thing in dimension has to do with these loop spaces. So now you can ask, what is this loop space? So the claim is that the dimension of this category is given by Durand cohomology of loop space of this bungee. Now, what is this loop space? This is something very familiar. Well, loop space here just means you take an object with an automorphism. So we have a G bundle on a Riemann surface together with an automorphism of that bundle. So this is like the group-like version of the Hitchin space. Instead of a Higgs, and that's why I'm calling it Higgs with a capital. Instead of a Lie algebra, a section of adjoint bundle, I have a group version. Sorry? That's right. Yeah, so here we're allowing arbitrary ramification. Huh? Arbitrary ramification, it's fine.
You are.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when I say bungee of sigma, I can use any bungee of sigma, bungee of with arbitrary level structure. Oh. This story is general. It doesn't require, yeah. My bungee means arbitrary level structure, yeah. I mean, I'll fix your favorite level structure. So I didn't want to put that in the slides, but you know, fix your favorite level structure, look at that bungee, take those D modules, its dimension is given by this Higgs space with the appropriate singularities. So singularities are given by the ramification. So that's covered by this kind of orange sidebar. But yeah, take your surface. Now I'll allow arbitrary number of points with any order poles. Yeah. So this story is, you know, what I'm doing now is very soft. I mean, it's completely abstract, so it doesn't really, yeah. So now the point is, that's right, so there's no twist here, but you can introduce, yeah.
You can twist
if you don't allow poles.
So in general, you can twist it at least by, right?
Yeah.
So it's a kitchen modular, traditional modular, the usual one, kind of like one, but you know, you know, like, yeah. challenge the case with the right equation to keep on.
Yeah.
You want to write something like g versus d by g plus.
I don't write any equation. that's why it's not a physics talk. It's not a hyperkähler. It's not a hyperkähler manifold. There's nothing related to twisting with the canonical bundle. This is just a claim. If you look at G bundles, yeah, there's no twisting is given by poles. Saying in the usual setting, you can capture twisting just by saying that you have poles given by the divisor on the Riemann surface. You can say a twisted one is the same as. Yes, absolutely. That's again. There's no note that doesn't mean anything. It has arbitrary pole. I mean, it's an automorphism of a bundle on a punctured Riemann surface. You have a punctured Riemann surface, you have a pole, and it's allowed to have poles of arbitrary order. I wouldn't call those essential singularities.
No, pole is not an essential singularity. That's what I'm asking. You don't measure poles now as order poles as in the vector space.
It's meromorphic.
It's now measured by points in the grass.
Yeah, the point is that's a different meeting. That's a different role. The point is this has nothing to do with that role. I mean, the appearance, if you'd like, of the Hitchin spaces in the whole fundamental NGO story has nothing to do with one forms.
So we just have that beta is like the order, the exponential of the.
Yeah.
But then if I is one form,
that's
quite
scale. Forget about one form. The terminology is, there are two types of things, confusion. In physics, terminology is fixed field global one form. No, real physics.
It's Hitchin's terminology.
In this context, people talk about Hitchin system.
Yeah, I didn't say Hitchin system. But I mean that's a definition of group like. I mean that's
the algebra value is actually a line bundle. Right? So that it's mathematically those modular spaces are also called Hitchin modular spaces. That's a confusion.
Okay.
So let's think in that context. So in that context,
So for example, locally, I would just have a puncture. If I don't specify any order of singularities, I have an element of the loop group up to conjugation. So depending on my trivialization of the bundle, I just have an element of the loop group around each puncture up to conjugation. And then there's an obvious analog of the Hitchin map, where I just take my element of the loop group and apply invariant polynomials to it. So it's basically a loop group. Let me get to that in a second. So the claim is, again, this theorem, again, holds for arbitrary singularities. The issue you have here is about understanding what the sentence means. But this theorem is true in general for arbitrary ramified spaces. And now since I'm now officially over time, let me point out that if you look in the Lie algebra version, the cohomology of these spaces, not the ones twisted by the canonical bundle, but twisted by arbitrary divisors with arbitrary poles, So omega, again, doesn't play a role. The symplectic hyperkähler structure plays no role in the story. But this is kind of the main object. The cohomology of the space is the central object in Ngo's work on the fundamental lemma. Fundamental lemma is a statement about the cohomology of this map. And it's an identity that you need that's sort of a key element of the Arthur Selberg trace formula. So what I wanted to conclude with is to try to match what Ngo's doing in this picture. So let me just say that what Ngo does is he studies something a little more refined. You look at the space, so he's actually studying what's called the Lie algebra version of the fundamental lemma. So the setting I have is you just remove Lie algebra, sort of would be the original fundamental lemma you're studying. You're looking at, instead of just looking at the cohomology, so we said that the cohomology of this whole space that I called Higgs, and maybe I shouldn't have called it. Anyway, the cohomology of that whole space, we said, is the dimension of the category of D modules on Bund G. So if you're interested in geometric Langlands or you're interested in Kapustin-Witten, whatever, the dimension of this space is the whole cohomology. Now, Ngo is interested in something more refined. He doesn't want the whole cohomology. He's looking at the Hitchin fibration. So he's doing it in the Lie algebra version. It's the familiar Hitchin fibration, except without symplectic structure. It's twisted by some other divisor. So I'm just, there's a version in this group, and you still have a kind of this map, which gives you a spectral curve. You could just look at, you have a loop group element, and you can generically attach it to a spectral curve locally. So you are interested in the cohomology of this map. In other words, the cohomology of the Hitchin fibers. Or another way to say it, you take the constant sheaf upstairs and push it forward to the Hitchin base. You get an interesting sheaf on the Hitchin base, which is just collecting all the cohomologies of the Hitchin fibers. That's the object that Ngo wants to study. Now, how does that relate to our story? So I said, so this is kind of the final punchline, I said that the entire cohomology of the Hitchin base is the dimension of this category. What about this more refined dimensions of the Hitchin fibers? And this is sort of the point, is that we have loop operators. D modules on Bund G is not just a plain old boring category. It's a category with a lot of symmetry. It has all the Etoft operators acting on it. So for every point on the Riemann surface, we have this, every unramified point, we have this collection of Etoft operators. Geometrically, there's a collection of, there's a Hecke algebra, which acts on this. And so the question is, you can ask a more refined question. If I give you a vector space, its dimension is a number. If I give you a representation of a group, its dimension is a class function. That's much more information. So the same thing here. Take these D modules on Bund G and ask, what is its dimension, not as a plain old category, but as a modules for these Hecke operators? And the answer is exactly the Ngo sheaf. Exactly this Ngo sheaf, this push forward, the cohomology of the Hitchin fibration. So the point is the cohomology of the Hitchin fibration, not just the cohomology of the total space, that's exactly capturing the information of this dimension. So this is the basic thing you might want to study in, and this is exactly what you would want to study in the trace formula. You have this object which is playing the role of some L2 space, some space of automorphic functions, now it's this category, and it has a bunch of operators on it. So what you'd like to understand is what is the traces of these operators. That's what the Arthur Selberg trace formula deals with. There's a natural field theory analog. You have this category of brains, it has this collection of Etoft operators. What is the trace? Now that trace is something that has to do with the surface cross the circle. And that's what the trace formula deals. And so in particular, the actual trace formula is given by S duality in this case. But, so you realize this exact same thing on the B side, and then you can describe what this trace is very geometrically, just in terms of flat connections on surface cross the circle. But anyway, that's maybe a good place to stop. Thanks. Yeah, so exactly. So let me, so it's actually a very nice, yeah. So there's a very nice story that the details are still being, this is all very, you know, current as in what we're doing next week with David. But so the story is as follows. So you say, okay, so now forget about Riemann surfaces. You just say, okay, you have this algebra of Etoft operators. And suppose I give you a module for that, something on which they act. And I'm looking at the Etoft line operator. I'm looking at the category. Etoft. Yeah, I mean this GL twist. You only have.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So so you have this category of these Etoft operators, and now you ask, what's going to be its its dimension. So it's where do so if I give you a module for it, where should that live? What do its characters live? You know, so we know that we know how to understand if you give me a group and I give you a representation of the group, we know the characters live are class functions. So you can ask for this Heck algebra, where are, or these Etoffed operators, where do its characters live? So if I gave you somewhere in the world, I went out and found a category in which they act, where would its character live? And you know, then specifically you can apply it to this particular example. So you can ask, what is that? And the answer is it's going to be this Heck category is some shadow of the loop group. So what you're going to find is that there's some shadow of character sheaves on the loop group. So the answer is what's called character sheaves on the loop group. So you look at the loop group, and you look at loop group equivariant flat vector bundles on the loop group. So the answer is the Heck algebra, the Hochschild homology of the Heck algebra. So you can make a precise mathematical statement, but Hochschild homology of the Heck algebra is, in other words, the place where characters live. These are class vector bundles on LG. Now, there's a lot of technical issues in making sense of that, because LG is very infinite dimensional. LG mod LG is really nasty. And this is where this beautiful story with putting a Q in comes in. So there's a regularized version of LG mod LG, which is G bundles on an elliptic curve. So if you look at LG acting on itself by Q conjugation, you get G bundles on an elliptic curve. And so the answer, again, this is something we're proving, is that the character of the Heck category is given by these character sheaves in the loop group are G bundles are D modules on bungee of an elliptic curve. So that's where the answers live. So this elliptic curve is again, of course, it's the same elliptic curve in the field theory. You're looking at a circle on my Riemann surface around a puncture, and I've done dimensional reduction, so there's a two torus there. So that's where that elliptic curve has nothing to do with sigma. It's in a different dimensions. It's not to do with this elliptic curve.
The elliptic curve we reduced on to go from four dimensions to
two-dimensional sigma? No, it's an elliptic curve that has to do with the circle. One circle comes from sigma, because I'm looking around a point on sigma, and another circle comes from the fact that I'm doing, what I'm doing is n equals 4 reduced on sigma cross a circle. N equals 4 reduced on sigma gives me this category. If I reduce on an extra circle, that gives me the dimension of this category. So I'm doing n equals 4 reduced on a circle cross sigma. In there, there's a two torus.
Yes.
And that's where these characters live.
Let's see, a two torus for any cycle.
For any point on the Riemann surface. I'm just thinking, for any point on the Riemann surface, I'm looking just points, I not cycle. Yeah, so I have a point around where I'm going to be measuring, where my Etoffed operator is living.
It's a linking circle at the point.
Of the Etoffed operator, exactly.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And so the point is that, now on the other hand, there's a theorem, geometric Satake theorem, that already told you this Heck category that I'm making a big deal of, you already knew what it is. It's just category representations of the dual groups by S-duality. So on the other hand, it's really trivial to figure out what its character is. So as a result of this, you deduce a form of geometric Langevin in genus 1, because you get to the elliptic curve, but you get an elliptic curve with G dual. And so you can deduce out of this by taking dimensions of the Heck category, either as Etoffed operators for G or as Wilson operators for G dual, you get a result on an elliptic curve, which is of independent interest. But the role of this is...
Physical language. Yeah.
Yeah.
And by S-duality, we know what that is, trivial.
That's right.
But if you actually want to calculate it...
On the A's?
Honestly,
yeah, that's right.
It's a big deal.
That's right.
Deal with these complicated modules.
Exactly.
What you're saying,
that's right. This is one level...
This machine is going to allow you to prove what you expect from S-duality rigorously?
Well, you already know that theorem for S-duality mathematically. This is a theorem of Mirkovich-Vilodin and Lustig, Drinfeld, various people, for the Heck category itself. For the Etoffed operators as a category itself, there's a theorem, it's a deep theorem, that does this. And now what I'm claiming is that this theorem for elliptic curve actually follows from this, just by this, that we now know mathematically what it means to cross with a circle, even in this fancier version. We know what it means to cross with a circle, and so we can get to the elliptic curve. And so the point is that this is the local where the local trace formula lives. This LG mod LG is a version of the Hitchin base, right? I mean, LG mod LG, you're looking at elements of the loop group under conjugation. These are basically spectral curves over the puncture disk. So this is basically the local version of the Hitchin base. It's just spectral curves over the puncture disk. That's where these characters live, like this NGO object. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's just, you know, you're looking at your Hitchin base over the puncture disk. You're now allowing, you know, so you have infinite the many quadratic differentials and so on. It's an infinite dimensional base. When I say, yeah, and But it, you know, it's all spectral curve over the puncture disk, and so that's a huge thing. And that's the point is that that's naturally where characters for these Hecke modules live. In particular, if you look at D modules on Bungee, look at this, what this n equals 4 theory assigns to sigma, that's that has a character which lives there, has a trace which lives there. And the point is that that's what the trace formula is about explaining these characters. And yeah, and so the point is you can prove some results by the amount of S-duality that we already, there's some results we already know in the math literature. And now if you think about this theory of dimensions and Hochschild homologies and whatever, you can kind of bootstrap out of that and get some more results. Right. I think it's very, very close in the, well, let's say this way. The formula, so the.
Sounds like the same thing. Except maybe you're saying this somehow splitting into a Hitchin 5 versus.
It's in the.
If you look at the trace formula, it's an isomorphism.
Yeah, it's a refined version, I think.
If you just talk about the dimensions, in other words, those vector spaces, then I think that's exactly what we know.
That could very well be. I'm not completely sure, but it's very much in the same spirit. But but the local version is a refinement.